From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, inside the presidential campaigns, Newsweek magazine sent three reporters to cover the workings of the three campaigns on the agreement that the reporters would not talk or write about what they saw until after the election. Well, the election is over, and we'll talk with the correspondents who covered the Clinton, Bush, and Perot campaigns. The reports have just been published in a special post-election edition of Newsweek. Also, Maureen Corrigan tells us about what people have left at the Vietnam Veterans Memorial in Washington, D.C. It's the subject of a new exhibition at the National Museum of American History. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President-elect Bill Clinton named the top officials of his White House transition team today. Their Washington lawyer, Vernon Jordan, the former director of the Urban League, and former Deputy Secretary of State, Warren Christopher. The Bush administration said today that it's ready to work with the Clinton team. Spokesman Marlon Fitzwater said that either Chief of Staff James Baker or his deputy, Robert Zoellick, would be available to help with the transfer of power. Many groups in France are calling on the government today to retaliate for the U.S. announcement of trade sanctions against the European community. Yesterday, Washington said it would impose 200% tariffs on white wine and other food imports from the EC. Lynn Terry has more from Paris.
The French Minister of Agriculture, Jean-Pierre Soisson, struck a defiant tone. He said if we lied down every time the United States raised its finger, we wouldn't exist. He's repeated that France will not give in to U.S. demands to reduce EC agricultural subsidies. Soisson's attitude was echoed by the French Minister for European Affairs, Elisabeth Guigou. She said France would ask the EC to take retaliatory trade sanctions against the U.S. The U.S. decision would mainly affect French exports of white wine. French wine growers are furious. They said that already U.S. buyers are starting to cancel orders, even though the sanctions are not due to take effect until early next month. They said they're being held hostage in a dispute that has nothing to do with wine. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
Leaders of the Jewish community in Germany have called on all sections of German society to resist what they describe as a shocking escalation of violence against foreigners there. From Berlin, the BBC's Diana Goodman reports.
The wave of right-wing violence which has swept across Germany recently shows no sign of abating, and police report that in one of the latest incidents, a black asylum seeker from South Africa was blinded in one eye when he was savagely beaten by youths wielding clubs. The German authorities say the attacks are increasingly well organized, making it hard for the police to respond. But Jewish leaders believe the threat from the right in Germany is not being taken seriously enough, and they compare what they see as the ineffectual response of the police today to the way that left-wing violence was handled in the past. In their open letter, members of the Central Council of Jews said that the terror against foreigners had taken on shocking dimensions in the past few months. And they stressed that because of the country's past, such attacks had a special significance.
The BBC's Diana Goodman. Stock prices declined slightly today despite positive news on the economy. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost about 4 points to close at 3,240. Advances led declines by a slight margin in heavy trading. Volume on the New York Stock Exchange was about 205 million shares. This is NPR. UN Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali outlined a plan today to reorganize the top levels of the United Nations staff, including measures to bring more women into policymaking positions. The secretary promised to raise the number of women at the UN's upper levels as close as possible to 50% by 1995, the 50th anniversary of the World Body. Boutros Ghali's administration has been criticized for reducing the numbers of women in high-profile jobs. Since the Egyptian diplomat took office, the only two women serving as undersecretaries general have left. The UN civil service also has an increasing number of complaints of sexual harassment. Seven Detroit police officers have been suspended following the beating death of a black man after a traffic stop last night. The city's police chief says a full investigation is underway. Don Gagne reports.
35-year-old Malice Green was driving his car last night when he was pulled over by two plainclothes police officers. According to police reports, five backup officers arrived on the scene, but it's not clear what happened next. At a news conference this afternoon, Detroit Police Chief Stanley Knox said Green was apparently pulled from the car and beaten with a flashlight while handcuffed. The beating continued even after an ambulance arrived. Green, who was black, died of severe head injuries at a Detroit hospital. Chief Knox said black and white officers were present, but he couldn't say how many actually participated in the beating. He also said he doesn't know if race was a factor. The police chief called the incident a disgrace and said such behavior on the part of the police won't be tolerated. All seven officers have been suspended. Knox says he expects at least some to face criminal charges. For National Public Radio, this is Don Gagne in Detroit.
The nation's largest regional telephone company said today that it will cut its workforce by about 8% within the next 4 years. Bell South said it will cut 8,000 jobs. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Now that the campaign is over, my guest can tell what he knows. Journalist Mark Miller spent the past year with the Clinton campaign. Bill Clinton granted Miller special access under the condition that he wait until after the election before writing about the campaign. Miller is a correspondent for Newsweek's special post-election issue, which has just been published. This issue also has behind-the-scenes reports on the Bush and Perot campaigns. Later we'll hear from the reporters who wrote those stories. Bill Clinton just won a solid victory, but 5 months ago, when he was about to come out the winner in the primaries, his campaign was in serious trouble.
It was a very interesting and frustrating time for him, because even as he was winning primary after primary and state after state, and he was clear he was going to be the nominee by, you know, June 2nd, for example, when he locked it up by winning California, Ohio, and New Jersey, he had won, but it didn't really matter. He was third in the polls. Perot had stolen all of his thunder. He was furious that Perot was getting the attention that he was. Perot essentially stole the mantle of outsider from him instantly and consigned Clinton and Bush to the same category as being part of the problem, not part of the solution. And everyone had written Clinton off. The press was sort of bored with him, and you know, the joke was that, you know, he was going to come in third and that the Democrats would, you know, be forever banished to after-run status. And so the campaign knew that something had to be done, obviously, since they were in such deep trouble. And they knew that he had a problem, but they weren't quite sure what it was. Most of the reporters covering the campaign thought that it was related specifically to the allegations of Jennifer Flowers or the draft, that these were these two twin character issues that were the problem for Clinton. And so his staff, after the New York primary, actually, while they were sitting in a hotel room pondering the future of the campaign or the lack of one, decided that they had to begin a research effort, which one semi-jokingly named the Manhattan Project in honor of where they were and also the nuclear nature of what they were dealing with in terms of Clinton's candidacy. And it was a $100,000 effort largely paid for by the Democratic National Committee, which involved focus groups, polls, memos written by outside consultants, dial groups in which people measured their reactions to things that they were watching on a television screen. And what they found was quite interesting. People were bothered by Clinton because they thought he was the typical politician. He was someone who would never tell them the truth. There's a fascinating focus group in Allentown, Pennsylvania, in which a woman who was struggling to express her feelings actually came up with one of the most, you know, cogent analysis of the campaign when she said that it's like if you asked Bill Clinton his favorite color, he would say plaid. And from then on, whenever Clinton would waffle on something, his staff would say, oh, you know, it's a plaid problem again. But that was the perception. His answers on Jennifer Flowers and the draft fed that perception, but they were not the problem per se. And they, you know, the campaign was somewhat relieved because they weren't convinced that you could fix the image of a perceived adulterer. But you could, they thought, fix the image of someone who seemed to be too political.
Is that why they decided to have him tell more of his personal story?
That's exactly why. Stan Greenberg, the pollster, found that when he presented the focus groups with details of his life, of Clinton's life, for instance, that he had grown up in a poorer home, that he had stood up to his alcoholic abusive stepfather, that he had worked his way through college, that he had taken on special interests in Arkansas. People's attitudes and perceptions of Clinton changed remarkably. I mean, you could see it in the progression of the focus groups, and it was actually quite dramatic. And they would begin to say things like, well, I've never read this before. I never knew this before. Sounds like he has more morals or ethics than the media gives him credit for. And by the end of the focus groups, those, this was the one I just cited, was one of 10 women. They were now voting for Clinton overwhelmingly. And the same thing happened among the men.
After the Jennifer Flowers story was damaging Clinton's standing, the campaign made the decision that he should go on 60 Minutes with Hillary Clinton and talk about their marriage. Who was behind that decision to go on 60 Minutes, and why was Clinton so angry at the way the segment turned out? You wrote that he was really, really upset when he watched it.
Yeah, he was furious. 60 Minutes was contacted by a member of Clinton's entourage, and wasn't a staff person per se, but it was one of his advisors. And they were very interested, obviously, at the prospect of having Bill Clinton come on their show. And it was to be for the show leading into Super Bowl, the Super Bowl game. So it was guaranteed to have an enormous audience anyway. And it was a risky move because Clinton was not particularly well known at that point. The things people knew about him were that he, you know, was being accused of having cheated on his wife. And so the idea that of going on national TV, talking to, you know, tens of millions of Americans for the first time and introducing himself as someone who was defending himself against charges of marital infidelity was a scary prospect to Clinton. And he worried about that. And he wasn't sure that if by going on 60 Minutes, it wouldn't give the press the right, or at least give them the excuse to go into all the rumors and other stories and all the allegations that had been made against him. Because up until that point, you know, the press coverage of Jennifer Flowers had been uneven. I mean, some papers had covered it, some papers hadn't. A lot of local TV had covered it, but some of the nets really hadn't covered it. So it was sort of uneven, and they weren't quite sure how it was going to shake down in the end. But they decided that, and this was something that James Carville, who by this point was emerging as his chief strategist, argued that it was better to deal with it in January than it would be to deal with it in the fall, and that they had to get it behind them, and that, you know, this was the kind of preemptive blow, or at least a tough way to stand up to the story, and that they should go on the nation's most famous, you know, the program perceived to be the toughest interview, and talk about the issues. And he was angry about it because in the negotiations with 60 Minutes, the program's producers had promised that it would run substantially longer than it had, than it did ultimately run. They also promised that other campaign issues would be discussed, and that the program would not be limited solely to Jennifer Flowers. And throughout the taping, as they answered questions, and it was quite an emotional taping, and many of their answers were quite powerful. The producers there told him that it was fabulous TV. They, you know, were just ecstatic by how wonderful it was. And Don Hewitt told him that, you know,
this is the producer.
Yeah, Don Hewitt, the producer, told him that he, you know, had thought that they'd had a hand in making one president before. I think he was referring to the debates, the Kennedy-Nixon debates, and that he thought that would happen again this time, and that the ending had been very powerful. The ending that they agreed was very powerful and didn't, in fact, run, and it was much shorter than they expected, and it dealt exclusively with Jennifer Flowers. And I think Clinton felt, part of it was just the tension and the frustration that he was feeling at that point, but he was angry with the way that the show had been handled.
My guest is Mark Miller, a correspondent for Newsweek, and he spent a year with the Clinton campaign, and he has a story about the Clinton campaign in the new election issue of Newsweek. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
We're talking about the Clinton campaign with Mark Miller, who's a special correspondent for Newsweek, and he spent a year with the Clinton campaign. Getting back to the Jennifer Flowers story, being inside the campaign during the Jennifer Flowers ruckus, did you get the impression that there ever was an affair between the two of them?
I got the impression that there had not been any sustained affair, and that there had not been anything that would actually qualify as an affair between the two of them. I think they knew each other. I'm not entirely sure what might have transpired between the two of them, but I don't believe that there was... let me put it this way. He was asked by one of his chief strategists whether or not he had had an affair with her, and Clinton's response was no, that he had not had a sexual affair with her. And that was done in privacy. And there was never any meeting in which, there was a discussion of, well, okay, I know people think I've had an affair, I did this with her, but we've got to say this. There was never anything like that. What you saw basically publicly was what he was saying privately.
The issue of the draft dogged Clinton throughout the campaign. In April, he said he was going to release all of his draft-related files, which he never did. Why didn't he?
I don't know. No one in his campaign is quite sure either. There were two people who knew the full story of Bill Clinton's draft record, and that was the candidate and a longtime aide named Betsy Wright. And their relationship was very strange and enigmatic to those on the staff who had not worked for Clinton before this presidential campaign, and actually even strange to those who had known Clinton for some time. She was the so-called Department of Defense. It was her job to defend the Arkansas record and to defend him against personal attacks. And she found the draft induction notice that he had admitted that he had received, but it was never released. And no one in the senior staff ever saw it. No one ever really knew what was the full story. She refused to share information, even with his closest confidants on the campaign and his senior staff. And it was just something that no one was quite sure what the truth was.
Are you suggesting that she kept this to have something on him in a way?
No, not deliberately. I don't think so, mm-hmm. No. I mean, she was completely devoted to Bill Clinton.
How worried were the managers of the Clinton campaign about the draft question?
Extraordinarily worried. That was their biggest fear. After the Republican convention, I asked one of the senior staffers, one of the senior consultants, about what he was most afraid of, and he said the draft, and they all agreed on that. I mean, it just hung over the campaign, you know, like a black cloud. They always felt its presence.
What were they most worried about?
They were worried about some of the stories that actually eventually came out. They were worried about whether or not they knew the full story. They were worried about how to answer reporters' questions because they weren't sure themselves of what the absolute truth was, and they didn't want to be caught having to reverse themselves on something that they had said. I mean, they were just very unsure of what the issue was. They even filmed a commercial at one point in which Clinton spoke directly to camera talking about the draft issue and how he, you know, recognized that he had not answered some of the questions as well as he should have, and that he recognized that some people might want to vote against him, but that he hoped that they would, you know, look to the future. He used that ad never ran, mostly because the focus groups showed that people were not that I shouldn't say that they weren't bothered by it. They were bothered by it, but they weren't going to vote on it. It was interesting. For a while, when you would present the focus groups with information on the draft, the people around the table would look down. And, you know, they would look at their shoes. They would sort of shuffle around. And, you know, they were clearly bothered by it. They didn't want to vote on it, but they were bothered by it. Once Bush made it an issue, once George Bush began raising it, it suddenly, in their mind, became another political attack. And they didn't care. They thought that Clinton had lied about the draft. They thought that he had probably dodged the draft, and they didn't care. Or they didn't want to hear anything more about it. They might care, they just were not interested, in another word, about the draft.
Hillary was kind of put in the closet by the campaign for a while because she had gotten the image of being too I guess, too much the feminist and too much the professional woman.
That is sort of true, but not completely. What they did lower her profile, but what she did was quite interesting. She began, I mean, she still toured the country. She still made many, many trips. But she was going principally to what they considered to be secondary markets, much smaller markets than the candidate could afford to go to and spend time on. And she did interviews with all the local press. She talked nonstop to local reporters. She just didn't do interviews with the national press. So our perception was she's dropped off the radar screen. They've muzzled her. But in fact, she was actually going around still doing her thing, just maintaining a slightly lower profile at doing it.
Now, you say that early on in the campaign, she saw the campaign as a rehearsal for 1996. She never expected that Clinton would actually win in 92. So she wasn't as diplomatic in some of the things that she was saying.
I think, and she said this to me again a few weeks ago, that she did not fully appreciate how much her words would be analyzed and how careful she had to be and how, in fact, people didn't know her and didn't know Bill Clinton, and that they didn't have a context for the things that she was saying, so that when they saw sound bites or snippets of conversations, they got a completely different or at least a distorted view of her than what she perceived herself to be, and she had to be careful about that.
Were there a lot of fights between Clinton and the campaign about how to handle certain issues or about, you know, how he should present himself?
I wouldn't say that there were a lot of fights. There were concerns on the part of the staff, for example, that his answers to hot-button issues like abortion tended to be too processy, tended to be too technical. I mean, it took him a long time to get to the point. You could, in one of the dial groups, for example, they showed an answer to a question about abortion in one of the televised town meetings that he did. And he sort of rambled along until he finally got, you know, 5 minutes into it, in which he said he supported the right to choose, and the line went up, signifying that people approved of what he was saying. But until then, it had been static, and he was losing people because it took him so long to get to the point of what he was saying. So there was a constant battle to try to make him more, you know, more punchy, more sort of, not exactly to produce more sound bites, but to get more to the point. And his view was, look, you know, these are complicated issues. These are not black and white issues. I don't have black and white feelings about them. People don't have black and white feelings about them. And, you know, I can't just whittle down everything into a 30-second stump speech.
Can you take us inside the room of the war room, so to speak, and tell us what the atmosphere was like in there when they were responding to a Bush attack?
Much like a command center in a you know, like a nuclear destroyer or something like that. I mean, it was obviously a lot less high tech than that, befitting James Carville's image. He would sit in the center of the room. There was an enormous table, a conference table that he sat behind. Mostly he lay on this couch. I mean, the couch was a fixture in all the campaigns that he's run, and he always has to have a couch, and he sort of lays there with his eyes half shut, sort of dreaming up new things to say and ways to respond to things. And he's surrounded by a bunch of young sort of minions who do his bidding, who were there to look up, you know, the latest economic statistics that Bush was attacking Clinton on in Arkansas that were misleading, or to hammer Bush on broken promises. There were people who dealt with polling, people who dealt with, you know, opposition research, people who, you know, dealt with getting the information to the press department. And it seemed somewhat disorganized, but it all seemed to function. They all had a job to do, and they all knew what they were doing, and they were all incredibly motivated. I mean, it was something to see, because they felt so painfully the experience of 1988 that they were just determined not to let that happen again.
What was the most frightening moment for the campaign inside the campaign, you know, from their perspective? The moment when things looked like they were about to disrupt?
Oh, there were so many. I mean, I had never really covered a campaign full time before, but anyone who had been connected with it had said that they had never gone through anything like this. I mean, it was such a manic depressive campaign. I mean, that was one way they referred to it. Carville said, you know, they ought to just put Prozac dispensers at the water fountains. In part because they were always, you know, so off. It was not a very even-keeled place to be in some cases, and some of the people around it were very strange and weird. But I think one of the worst moments, there were a couple of horrible moments for them, and one was the day before Junior Tuesday, the primaries in Georgia and Maryland and Colorado. The day before, they thought it was over. People actually left the headquarters and went to long lunches and talked about what they were going to be doing. They were just convinced that they would not get a sizable enough win in Georgia and that Tsongas was actually going to win at that point. And, of course, the next day he got a huge majority in Georgia and Georgia saved him and he went on and killed off Tsongas as a candidate. And then the other one was the day of the June 2nd primaries, the last rounds of primaries, the day he had locked it up. He gave a speech that night claiming victory, but it was the most sort of... He seemed quite down and quite rattled, and the campaign was down. It was the most anticlimactic victory I'd ever seen. And I think they just, at that point, were not quite sure what they could do and whether or not they could win.
James Carville of the Clinton campaign and Mary Madeline of the Bush campaign have been romantically involved. What do you think it was like for Carville to try to continue that relationship while they were in opposite camps?
It was difficult for both of them, particularly at the debates when they would be in the what was called spin alley, and they would be spinning reporters on their perceptions of how the debates had won. And, you know, they would be standing a few feet away from each other, and I think it was quite difficult for them both. It was more difficult for her in some ways because she was losing. And, you know, it's always more difficult when you're losing.
How much were they seeing each other during the campaign?
Oh, after June, Carville spent almost all of his time in Little Rock, and I think he saw her a few times in Washington. He didn't generally take much time off, mm-hmm. and she didn't have a lot of time on her own either. They talked a lot on the phone, but they did not have vast amounts of time to see each other.
One last question. Did observing the campaign from such a close vantage point make you any more or less cynical about American politics?
I have mixed feelings about it. I became much more cynical and much more sort of disgusted with Washington in general. I mean, I can't tell you the number of times we watched the talk shows, the pundit shows in Washington pronounced Clinton dead, and, you know, there's just no way he could win. And, you know, they were always wrong. And there were, you know, one of the lead reporters for the New York Times, whom I probably shouldn't name, would write stories that were just completely wrong and so out of touch with what was really happening with people. And I became much more cynical about our connection, the press's connection, with what real people are actually thinking. And that is something that I would want to guard against should I be covering a campaign in the future or an administration. I mean, they become just as sort of isolated as the president can be in his White House.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Mark Miller is a correspondent for Newsweek. His report on the Clinton campaign is published in a special election edition of the magazine. On the second part of our show, reports on the Bush and Perot campaigns. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Toward the end of the presidential race, the Bush campaign seemed to gather momentum. But did they really believe they could win? Coming up, we look at the workings of the Bush campaign with Newsweek's senior White House correspondent Tom DeFrank. He was one of three Newsweek reporters assigned to spend 1 year with the presidential campaigns. The reporters asked for special access under the condition that they would not write or talk about what they saw until after the election. We'll also talk about the Perot camp with reporter Andrew Murr. And Maureen Corrigan reviews Personal Legacy, The Healing of a Nation, a new exhibit of objects left at the Vietnam Veterans Memorial in Washington, D.C. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President-elect Bill Clinton has named veteran civil rights leader Vernon Jordan and former State Department official Warren Christopher to lead his transition team and advise him on top government jobs. Jordan will serve as chairman of the transition team, and Christopher will be in charge of day-to-day operations. Even though Christopher today appeared to rule himself out of a cabinet job, top Clinton aides say that Clinton has not done so. Both Jordan and Christopher served on Clinton's vice presidential screening team. Middle Eastern peace talks, which paused for the U.S. presidential election, will resume Monday. NPR's Ted Clark reports that a key U.S. player in these talks plans to step up his efforts.
Dennis Ross, who left the State Department with Secretary of State James Baker to help the Bush campaign, will return to the department probably next week. Ross, as the department's director of policy planning, was intimately involved in setting up the Mideast negotiations during months of shuttle diplomacy last year. Many Mideast analysts expect the Bush administration to give a last push to the peace process in the president's remaining 10 weeks in power. Bill Clinton has promised to continue the talks without hiatus. Israeli, Palestinian, Jordanian, Syrian, and Lebanese negotiators returned to Washington, D.C. over the weekend and will resume their talks on Monday. Israelis and Palestinians are still trying to agree on a form of limited self-government for the occupied territories. Israelis and Syrians are still trying to agree on a statement of principles to guide their talks. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
In New York City, UN Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali has told a committee of the UN General Assembly that the world body's fiscal problems are now endangering the lives of UN staff. Linda Fasulo reports.
Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali presented a reorganization plan that would streamline the world body at a time when it faces a record $1 billion deficit, much of it owed by the U.S. The U.N. chief also told member states that underfunded missions would jeopardize the lives of U.N. personnel, and in good conscience he could not do so. And he recommended that the Security Council take action to punish those groups or countries which put UN staff in danger, but he did not elaborate with details. Regarding the composition of the UN's workforce, Boutros-Ghali promised to increase the number of women in top posts. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Fasulo at the UN.
Contract talks are now underway involving more than 200,000 miners in 8 states. Both sides concede that there are tough questions to be decided. Neither side announced what it considered the major issues in the talks. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down nearly 4 points to close at 3,240.06 on volume of 205 million shares. This is NPR News. Top officials in Europe are calling for trade talks with the United States to resume. Because of concern over a possible trade war between the UN and the European Community, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade has slated a meeting for next week. A GATT spokesman says that higher U.S. tariffs are a threat to free trade around the world. GATT has been trying for a number of years now to get a new agreement on lowering trade barriers, but this has been stopped by a U.S. EC dispute over farm subsidies. Now U.S. officials have promised a 2% increase in import taxes on several EC products, but mainly white wine. These tariffs are mainly directed at France. National Guard troops in Florida have been authorized by the governor to patrol interstates in Jacksonville because of a series of sniper and rock-throwing attacks. Cindy Hospin of member station WUFT reports from Gainesville.
The response response from Florida Governor Lawton Chiles comes one day after AAA warned tourists to stay away from the area. Florida National Guard Brigadier General Richard Capp says 25 to 30 jeeps and helicopters with infrared sensing capabilities will now begin patrolling Interstate 295 in the Jacksonville area. The governor's executive order comes after one death and several injuries following the unsolved sniper and rock-throwing incidents in recent weeks. The National Guard will join the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office and the Florida Highway Patrol. The problems come at a bad time here in Florida. It's right before the start of the tourist season. For National Public Radio, I'm Cindy Hosbein in Gainesville, Florida.
For the first time in 8 months, consumer borrowing moved up in September after falling nearly 2% in both July and August. Installment credit climbed by 2.7% in September. All this year, consumers have been paying off old debts instead of adding to the money they already owe. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. The Republicans are moving out of the White House. Where did their campaign go wrong? We're continuing our behind-the-scenes look at the three presidential campaigns. My guest, Tom DeFrank, is senior White House correspondent for Newsweek. His report is published in the new post-election special edition of Newsweek. He was assigned to spend the past year with the Bush campaign. Newsweek asked the campaign to grant special access under the condition that DeFrank wouldn't report anything he saw or heard until after the election. Although the campaign did not grant special access, DeFrank still kept his promise to not print his story until after the election. I asked him if there were any stories he wished he could have gotten out as they were happening.
I guess there are many stories like that, but one that I would single out is learning that as early as July, Vice President Quayle thought this election was over. And while he was very loyal to the president and did very good work in the president's behalf, and I think probably ran a better campaign than a lot of people around the president, the fact that the vice president told some of his aides in July that we can run a perfect campaign the rest of the way and we'll still lose, that's something obviously I would have loved to have seen in print in July, but the rules were that I couldn't, and so I didn't.
Why did Quayle think that?
He thought, and still does, that this has been a very poorly run campaign, a campaign without a clear focus, a campaign with organizational problems, a lack of coordination and cooperation between the White House and the campaign. And basically, he thought this was a timid campaign. It wasn't bold enough. It wasn't aggressive enough. Dan Quayle believes in offense, that if you're not on the offense in politics, then sooner rather than later, you're going to be put on the defensive.
A lot of people felt that the Bush campaign started to derail with the Republican convention. How did Pat Buchanan get such a prominent role within the convention? What happened behind the scenes?
Well, that's one of the untold stories. Basically, the Bush campaign needed Buchanan. The president was always worried about offending the right wing of his party. And so they had to make a deal with Buchanan. And basically, Buchanan was going to speak on Tuesday night, but it looked like he might not get prime time on Tuesday night, so he said he wanted to go some other night, and the folks at the Bush campaign said, why don't we put him on Monday night? Reagan is speaking Monday night, so we'll make that party unity night. It sounded good in theory, but in execution, really what everybody in America saw first from the Republican convention was a very harsh speech from Pat Buchanan, which basically said, if you don't think like we do, to hell with you.
So they didn't know what his speech was going to be.
Well, they put out a story that he didn't clear his speech, but the fact of the matter is two of the president's senior officials read that speech 24 hours before it was delivered, and they didn't make any changes to it. So they had a chance. That's contrary to the public belief, but they had a chance to do something with that speech, and they didn't do anything with it.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Tom DeFrank. He's senior White House correspondent for Newsweek, and he wrote the long essay on the Bush campaign for the new special election issue of Newsweek. One idea in the Bush campaign was to send a letter to Bill Clinton on the day of the first debate demanding that he make public his draft files, which he had earlier said he would do. Who was for that? Who opposed it?
Well, I think everybody was for it except the president, Bob Teeter, Fred Malek. I think more or less everybody thought that might be a good idea, because the idea in the first debate was to make some news. But the president just basically did not feel comfortable doing that. The president is a gentleman. He can mix it up, and I know that sounds a little little weird considering just how tough he was in the last 3 or 4 weeks of the campaign, calling Clinton Governor Waffle and Senator Gore Ozone Man, and finally he just started calling him Ozone. But the president just was not comfortable in doing that, and the president did not think it was smart or dignified, and I think he missed an opening. Time and again, there are instances where the president might have been tougher, might have been able to dominate the debate, but for his own reasons, he chose not to do so. He was urged, for example, at one point in the first debate, to announce that he'd have a new economic team in the second term, and to announce that he had was planning to ask for the resignations of all of his senior government officials, and that Jim Baker was coming back. The only announcement he made was that Jim Baker would remain on at the White House as economic czar. The rest of that he didn't announce, and his aides thought he was going to. He just somehow didn't feel comfortable doing it.
This was during the debate he was supposed to announce this?
This was during the first debate.
If President Bush is such a gentleman as a campaigner, what came over him in those last couple of weeks when he started talking about, bozos and ozone and... It wasn't exactly what you'd call presidential talk. I mean, it was almost adolescent.
Well, at the end of this campaign, I think you saw a declaration of independence from what the president has always called, with great revulsion, the handlers. A couple of weeks ago in an interview, he was saying that he didn't expect to be out of office until 1997, but when he was out of office, he was going to get into the grandchildren business, and he was going to get into the golf business, and he was going to get rid of handlers. He said, there will be no handlers to tell me things like I can't go out in my motorboat because it looks bad. He says, they're going to be gone. When I heard him say that, I said to myself, uh-oh, we're going to see a different George Bush the rest of the way. And I think what he was saying was, I think I'm probably going to lose this thing, and if I'm going to lose it, I'm going to lose it my own way. I'm going to lose it doing things that I'm comfortable doing and I'm comfortable saying, and to hell with these handlers. And he started throwing away his speeches, and he started getting a little hyperbolic, and he overdid it a little bit. I think the American people probably think that bozos is not a word that he should have used, and probably in retrospect he probably feels the same way now. But I think it was a way of him saying, I'm going to run this campaign, and I'm going to bring this thing home my way. I'm not going to be handled any longer.
What do you think the campaign strategists thought of Bush's use of, bozos and ozone and all that?
Well, the campaign handlers were not happy with that kind of language, and they tried to gently suggest to him that maybe he should throttle back. And as a matter of fact, Barbara Bush, Mrs. Bush, felt the same way and told him so. And she was out with him for a day, and it got better. But then when she left the trail, he went back to what he was doing.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Tom DeFrank, senior White House correspondent at Newsweek. There's a new special election issue of Newsweek, and Tom DeFrank wrote the extended essay about what happened behind the scenes at the Bush campaign. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Tom DeFrank, who is senior White House correspondent for Newsweek. There was a movement inside the Republican Party to dump Quayle. How close did he come to getting replaced? Who wanted him replaced? Who were his supporters?
Well, I don't think the vice president had a whole lot of supporters within the senior command of the Bush campaign. I think Bob Teeter and Fred Malek would have been just as happy to see Vice President Quayle go. They knew it would be a political problem because conservatives would be furious. But I believe if evidence could have been shown that Quayle was a big liability, and I mean a major liability, several questions were thought about Vice President Quayle, and the results were inconclusive. The numbers showed that Quayle hurt the president, but only by a little bit, and that it was not conclusive or definitive by any means.
You write that the whole Murphy-Brown idea was really Marilyn Quayle's idea. She wanted Dan Quayle to take on the entertainment industry, and that Dan Quayle, in fact, had never watched Murphy-Brown.
Well, the vice president had never watched Murphy-Brown, and Marilyn Quayle did have this idea, although it's in fairness to the vice president, he wasn't being manipulated by his wife here. I mean, he has always talked about the values and family values, but it was Mrs. Quayle who came up with the notion of using Murphy Brown as the personification of many of the things that the Republicans didn't like about current lifestyles.
When Quayle started talking about Murphy Brown's decision to have the baby, did his staff know that he was going to do this?
The vice president's staff had several meetings with the vice president in which they talked about how to deal with the Murphy Brown business. This was a calculated strategy.
It was calculated among the people in his staff, but what about the larger campaign? Did they know?
The vice president was pretty good all the way along with letting the campaign know what he was up to, but the vice president figured that the campaign honchos weren't going to like this Murphy Brown business all that much. So the campaign got a little bit of advance notice, but not a lot of advance notice. They got a couple of hours notice, and at that point the speech text was already drafted, so there was no way that they could call up in horror and stop it. They tried to get him to dial back, but the president didn't seem to have any problem with it at all. It was the campaign that got all flustered and felt that it was a big mistake.
It was reported in the New York Times yesterday in a story by Maureen Dowd that Mary Madeline, the deputy campaign manager, complained to Bush that the party was getting the image of being intolerant and homophobic. I wonder if you knew about that and if you know what the president's reaction was.
Well, the president was told that, and he seemed to be kind of startled. The president is not that way. The president's not a gay basher. The president is not an intolerant person, and he seemed to be somewhat surprised that people would feel that way. But it is true that Mary Madeline felt that way, and some of the other people on his staff felt that way. And by the time it became clear that this was a problem, it was really too late to fix the problem.
One last question. Is there any one thing you could point your finger to that would help describe how the campaign looked different from the inside than it did from the outside?
I always thought that internally the campaign was always in worse shape at any given point than it seemed on the outside. It just seemed to be racked with indecision and power struggles and half starts and indecisions. It was always kind of at sea the whole time. I mean, from the day I started covering this campaign for this election project, it always seemed to me that it was like the last days of Pompeii inside the Bush campaign, even a year ago. It just smelled bad. It just was a place that just seemed like it was going to not work out from the very start. There just was a bad karma in there, and I don't know what happened or why it happened, but it was just not a happy place and not a comfortable place and not a place that seemed to be clicking. The vibes were bad from the very start.
Tom DeFrank, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks a lot.
Tom DeFrank, a senior White House correspondent for Newsweek. Andrew Murr covered the Perot campaign for Newsweek's special post-election issue. He asked for special access under the condition he wouldn't reveal anything until after the election, but he didn't get special access, and like the rest of the press, he didn't get much access at all. I asked Murr about the night it all started, when Perot appeared on the Larry King show and promised to run if his supporters got him on the ballot in all 50 states.
The story had actually started some months before. A lot of people Perot knew, and even people Perot didn't know, were calling him up, writing him, faxing him, trying to get him to run for president. In some cases, they wanted him to run as a Democrat, in other cases as an independent. There was a guy in Nashville, a businessman, sometimes in the news business. He's been a franchiser, a fellow named John J. Hooker. Hooker got interested several months before Larry King in having Perot run for president. Would call him, Perot, and he would talk sometimes three and four times a week. And Hooker, like a lot of other people, was saying, get in the race, you can do it, it can happen. All you got to do is tell the American public that you're doing it, and it will happen. That went on for a long time, went up to about the 1st of February, and Perot called up and said, I'm coming to Nashville, and I'd like to see you. And Hooker said, well, that'll give me a chance to talk to you face-to-face to talk you into this race. By the end of that evening, the two of them had gotten together, and Perot had said, well, if people put me on the ballot in all 50 states, I guess I'll do it. The next day, Perot made that statement in public in Nashville. Didn't really go anywhere. It was published in the papers, but nothing happened. Came another couple of weeks. Perot was to go on Larry King to talk about the President's State of the Union address. And Hooker and some other people started calling King to say, you know, if you press him hard enough, he'll make the same statement, but you really do have to press him. So if you go back and look at the transcript of the Larry King show, you'll see that King asked him two or three times, said, well, a fellow in Nashville named John J. Hooker says that you'll run. Nothing happened. It got down to about 5 minutes left in the show, and King hit him again with it, and he made the 50-state declaration, and he was in.
How much do you think King knew was going to happen? I mean, do you think he figured out?
King seemed awfully surprised that Perot was saying no at the top of the show. He hit him as hard as Larry King hits anybody. Three or four times the same question. You wouldn't run. Aren't you going to run? So King clearly went into that show thinking that Perot was going to use it as a platform to make the declaration. And in fact, Perot was, but he was going to talk about the economy and he was going to talk about lots of other stuff before he got around to it. One interesting question in my mind is what would have happened had King not come back to that question. Perot let him refuse to answer the question for the first 50 or so minutes of that hour-long talk, and I wonder what would have happened had King not come back at the end of the show and followed it up again.
Andrew Murr's report on the Perot campaign is published in Newsweek's special election issue. This is Fresh Air. Lynn Neary is with us. Lynn, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Well, Terry, NPR's Mara Liasson will have the latest from the Clinton headquarters in Little Rock on the transition. And Tom Gelton will have a report on the destruction of the Bosnian Muslim town of Kozarac. The once prosperous community was home to 25,000 people. 90% of them were Bosnian Muslims. Now the town is abandoned. And we'll also have a conversation with saxophonist Stanley Turrentine about his new record, More Than a Mood. And he tells us that he learned a lot about playing the sax from his father when he was growing up in Pittsburgh.
Thanks, Lynn. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The Vietnam War as a political issue may or may not have been put to rest with the end of this presidential campaign. A new exhibition, which opened last week at the National Museum of American History in Washington, D.C., considers how some Americans have tried to come to terms with the legacy of Vietnam. It's entitled Personal Legacy, The Healing of a Nation, and it displays 500 of the over 25,000 objects that have been left at the Vietnam Veterans Memorial since its dedication in November of 1982. Commentator Maureen Corrigan went to see the exhibit.
If you live in Washington, D.C., as I do, you find that every time friends from out of town come to visit, you wind up taking them on the obligatory tours of the Washington Monument, the Lincoln Memorial, and the Air and Space Museum. But there's one place I've managed to visit only twice in 4 years. That's the wall, the Vietnam Veterans Memorial. I'm lucky. The older cousin of mine who went to Vietnam came back. So it's not like there's any particular name up there that's too painful for me to see. It's like they're all too painful to see, all 58,183 of them, and so many of them the same age as the college freshmen I now teach. Despite what Ross Perot says, I think the wall is the most moving memorial we have. When people go there, they don't just stand back and look. They touch it. They see their sorrow reflected in its black granite panels. And from the very beginning, they've left offerings there for the dead. These personal rites of remembrance began even before the memorial was finished. One day, while construction workers were pouring concrete for the wall's foundations, a man walked up and asked if he could throw his brother's purple heart into the wet concrete. He saluted it as it slid beneath the surface. Maybe that first offering cast a neo-pagan spell over the wall, because ever since, people have been leaving not only the flowers, flags, and religious objects that decorate other war memorials, but TV sets, cans of fruit cocktail, sticks of gum, toy cars, bottles of bourbon, and foot powder, the same sorts of things the ancient Egyptians used to place inside pyramids to ensure that their loved ones would enjoy the next life. I went to see the exhibit of objects from the wall the day before Election Day, when almost everybody on the streets of Washington sounded like they were trying out for the McLaughlin Group. But inside the museum, in a small dark room, the only sounds were sighs and sniffles, someone blowing their nose or mumbling to themselves, the same sounds you hear at the wall. I joined a crowd that filed very slowly past a high glass cabinet filled with clues to personality. There's a pair of old, cracked Birkenstock sandals in this exhibit, a golf trophy, hundreds of dog tags and MIA bracelets, a beautiful golden trumpet in a velvet case and a pair of black lace panties, wedding rings, and a baby pacifier. There are also letters that testify to the terrible persistence of grief. One reads, "Pete, it's been almost 17 years since that night we lost you over Laos." This exhibit highlights how Vietnam, unlike other wars, is still so unresolved in people's minds. The metaphors for trying to understand it keep changing and growing, like the objects left at the wall. A guard told me that the exhibit is already having a powerful boomerang effect. Lots of people are going from the exhibit to the wall. I don't know how they can take so much in one day. Instead, I went home to listen to the 11th-hour TV discussions of Campaign 92 issues like character and the economy, and yes, Vietnam. And despite what some politicians say, I thought about how, for the people most tragically affected by the Vietnam War, there's no one way to think about it or to remember.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. Personal Legacy remains at the National Museum of American History through June 7th. Fresh Air's senior producer today was Fred Landerl. Our engineers this week are Audrey Voblaitis, Richard Parker, and Thad Kirk. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shirok directs the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Dr. Ursula Zeiniger is a surgeon who specializes in breast cancer. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Dr. Zeiniger about diagnosing her own breast cancer. Living with the disease gave her new insights into her patients. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.